handle the truth.
Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Prick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. It is 8:19 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on June 2nd in the year of our Lord, 2020. All right. Well, I got about 5 hours and 45 minutes of sleep last night, so I'm feeling extra juiced. That's a little more than I've been getting recently. Not enough, but that's why I have a slightly more pep in my vocal step. But it's weird times we're living through right now, as I've written on Twitter. It's like basically 1861 plus 1929 plus 1968 plus some brain damage, and that's Donald Trump. That's the Donald Trump era. It's my uncle's birthday today, so can't see him. But for those of you that don't know, my uncle lived across the hall from my family from the age of 6 until present, my family being just my mom now, as far as our original home. You know, the home that there'll be like a landmark plaque in front of when I die and become, you know, when I'm a comedy icon, it'll be a stop on a tour of the Bronx. Probably not, because it's an apartment building. It's probably hard to make an apartment within a building a landmark, but you know what I mean, as I head towards comedy icon status. But I got him a card at the dollar store, which was only 53 cents, so I felt like I was really getting a pretty big win by getting a half-off dollar store card. And they're pretty much the same, guys. I realized I've been paying, you know, $4.79. Sometimes I get those papyrus cards or papyrus. I never know how to pronounce it, but that's when I'm really flexing, is when I go and I go, yeah, I'll take the $9.99 card that instead of licking the envelope, you put a gold sticker over it like you're some sort of a medieval knight sending your seal. But then I walked into the dollar store because I didn't want to be out too much because I'm afraid of getting COVID. And got a cheap card there. And the cool thing is, they don't put that on the back. The back of the card has, like, you know, $2.79, so it doesn't look like you're super cheap, but in reality it was a 53-cent card. But I've used my newfound Twitter celebrity for very little so far. But the one thing I did do, and I don't think my uncle listens to this podcast, like most of my family doesn't listen to any of this, I don't think. My mom sometimes, when she gets bored, and she always manages to like listen to the most depressing episodes, so I'll get like an email or a call like 4 hours after the episode goes up, and she goes, are you okay? You sound, maybe comedy's not for you. but Bob Gunton, well-known actor to anybody who likes movies. He's had a fascinating guy, a Bronze Star winner in Vietnam. As his Twitter bio says, former seminarian, progressive Catholic. So that's, you know, I like, obviously I like that. nominated for multiple Tony Awards, like in musicals, and then is probably most well known as the warden in Shawshank Redemption. And he became a big fan of mine on Twitter, which was very, very cool. He doesn't have a big Twitter following, which I just figured somebody of his celebrity would have more Twitter followers than he does. But I guess he just probably does it for himself, and for, you know, keep up on what he wants to keep up on. But he's been very effusive in his praise for my Trump content, not just the impression, but he finds the what I'm doing with it to be very impressive. And that means a lot, because he's not a comedian, but he's somebody who knows maybe acting and character work. So he finds that he loves the videos. So I sent him a direct message and said, hey, and this is all true, the most impressed my uncle has been this whole run of me finally getting some recognition and widespread views is the fact that Bob Gunton is a huge fan. Like that legitimately, my uncle found that to be really, really cool, because my uncle was the one who brought the name Bob Gunton to me, because he's such a... My uncle loves Shawshank Redemption. I think his favorite actor in Shawshank Redemption, favorite performance in Shawshank Redemption was the warden. And I think my uncle knew stuff about him before I did. Like, you know, just when you're a retired older man and you have the internet, you just go, oh, I like that actor, let me look up some stuff. So Mr. Gunton agreed to send a happy birthday signed headshot to my uncle, which, you know, in the era, if we really believe in the thought that counts, then that's a highly thoughtful gift. And it was so nice, he agreed to do it right away. So I'm hoping the birthday's today, and I'm hoping it gets there today, but at least this week would be cool. So that's a nice, you know, that's... I've been very negative, I think. I've been told by some people, not that the podcast isn't at least enlightening, but has had sort of a negative tone recently. So I thought I'd start with some good news before going full negative. But that's nice, isn't it, folks? Isn't that a nice little story of JL calling in a favor, using his power for good? So anyway, that's this week's piece of good news. Now on to the shit show. I want to predict something for my listeners, as this is the more exclusive club, and then I'm not going to address this topic again. But I want to paint you a picture, and I genuinely don't know if I'd done this on a previous episode, because I'm losing my mind during quarantine. Days are blurring together, weeks are blurring together, I don't know what's going on. But my prediction is, when Saturday Night Live comes back, I will not receive an audition. Which is okay. That would just continue my streak, my hot streak of 17 years. I'm not being recognized for my impressions. And also the one time I met with a high-powered manager in 2013 after my Louis C.K. video went viral, and he said to me, I can get you an audition for SNL, but you might be too tall. And then they asked me to do another couple of videos based on some of the impressions I told them, and I did, and I emailed them, and I got a response back, and then they stopped responding. So that's the usual showbiz story. It's like, yes, I'll jump through hoops for you if you show interest, and then you just ghost. You professionally ghost me. So, like I've said, I've had the only people who haven't contacted me so far in this journey have been agents, managers, and show bookers, meaning comedy clubs and TV. That's the only three groups of people who haven't contacted me. Are the three groups most likely to propel my career beyond Twitter fame. But my prediction is that what happens is Alec Baldwin decides not to do Trump. Okay, and the people at SNL say, you know what? We're not going to do better than Alec Baldwin, famous A-list actor. He won Emmys for playing Trump, so he's clearly the GOAT. Now, you know, a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of like, well, we had Alec Baldwin on SNL, and this is the biggest platform for impressions, so therefore, there can be no one better than Alec Baldwin. Like a circular, sort of circular reasoning. So my prediction is that they say, what if we think outside? Let's not even go for an impersonator, which immediately then just like renders my officially GOAT impression moot. Like, it becomes totally useless. And they go, what if we go in a different direction? You know what's really genius? this woman who's been doing the TikTok videos. She's a black woman. She's, you know how much Trump hates it when women play members of his cabinet. What if we do like an Andy Kaufman thing and have her do her Trump lip syncs as our new Trump? How crazy would that be? That would, and then media across the universe just guffaws and falls all over each other, and I get a bunch of private messages from comedians going, "Holy shit, dude! I'm sorry, this is obscene." That's my prediction. That's I'm calling it here. If there was a way for me to bet on that, I would. I'm basically shorting myself and going long on TikTok. Okay, so that's my gambling advice. If they have if DraftKings has SNL odds, there you go. There's my handicap for the summer. And then this other guy. Oh my God! This is the real thing. And then I want to talk about my time as a prosecutor, which I think is a valuable story. For those of you that don't know, my first job out of law school was as a prosecutor in the Bronx, and no great renown. I didn't accomplish so much in my 3.5 years there, but I think it's instructive experience considering what we're dealing with law enforcement right now in this country. So we'll get to that in a second. But what I was going to say is, there's my first brain fart of the episode. No, I can't wait to get out of my apartment and do, I hope at some point I can work some comedy clubs. If anybody contacts me at some point to either represent me or book me, because right now I'm still sitting here going, yeah, I have no idea if my career is just, if I'm just going to be making a little bit more money on Cameo and YouTube, and that the career I actually want is going to stall out or not happen still. Because, you know, I know most of the people who listen to this know me for more than my Trump. Maybe not everybody, but most people know me for more than my Trump. But my YouTube channel is just littered with like tons of stand-up content and tons of like well-produced sketches and many, many, many other impressions. And that's still like the side project, because stand-up is the thing that I've worked the hardest and the longest at. And that's what I want to do. So like, I feel confident that when I get up in front of audiences doing my stand-up, that I will retain them as fans. They may come out for like some Trump stuff and like my sense of humor or my politics, but I think any real stand-up fan, which is another dilemma, is like weeding out people who might just like witty stuff on Twitter about politics, and then figuring out, okay, which ones of you are real stand-up fans? Because the truth is, you know, the Trump fans are like Pamela in Teen Wolf. By the way, looking through it through an adult's eyes, overrated. Like, let's go back to Teen Wolf for a second. As a kid, it's so funny how you get ingrained with shit when you're watching that movie. You're like, oh my God, well, of course, like the blonde who's an actress who's trying to be seductive, that's the hottie. Boof is just like some cute whatever Pat Benatar haircut chick who lives down the block from Scott. As an adult watching that movie, I'm like, Boof is way prettier than Pamela. Like, how brainwashed we can get into like, well, you know, blonde, tan blonde actress who gets naked in the dressing room for Teen Wolf. That's the hottie. And then you look at Boof and you're like, she's way hot. Like, they may have made her, but she's much cuter. And it's so fun. I don't know. Anyway, in other words, the Trump fans are the Pamelas. The Pamela's from, I think I got the name right. I know Boof, of course, but they even give her a stupid nickname or name, Boof. But but the Trump fans are the Pamela fans. They're like, oh my God, you're amazing. You're a genius. I love this stuff. You're my favorite comedian. I go, okay, that's cool. That's cool. But you've got to like, hopefully you actually look at my other, you know, the 96% of my other comedy content, including the 6 stand-up albums, before you determine that I'm your favorite comedian. Because What I'm learning is that there's a lot of non-comedy fans out there. There's just a lot of people who want to be in on the moment, who want a virtue signal, who want to like indicate who they are as people, like use the comedy they support to indicate who they are as people. And I accept all that support, but I'm not stupid. Like, the people that are going to keep me working and maybe propel my career long term. Oh, look at that. I couldn't even say long term. It's like I gagged when I said long term, because it's like I don't even believe it will happen. But are the people who like my stand up and who like the breadth of my comedy, not just like this one thing. So I welcome everybody in who likes the Trump, but like I know for a fact the people that will keep me working and possibly give me a lifelong career as a comedian are those who like the other stuff and embrace the other stuff and see that that's what real comedy is and what a real comedian is. But I got to get out of the fucking Trump impression world, because it's like the dregs of stand-up comedy. Like I feel like over my career I have gained respect from many, many A-list comedians for my stand-up and for my content, not just for like this one thing. You know, whether it's Gaffigan or Gullman or people like that, or just having worked with some really strong people, and I think always at least what's the word? Not equipping, whatever. You know, just doing a good job on the road consistently and having people, you know who I am, at least for some of my stand-up. But this Trump impression world is so fucking weird. It's like one Trump impersonator blocked me. Fuck him. Because I never did shit to him, but it was like, I think he wanted to start doing what I was doing, and was, you know. And that's the other thing. For so many years, I was still doing this impression, and that's what made me sort of cynical about comedy, is that like, oh, if I have been seen for this Trump impression and I still can't get recognized, and all these people with inferior impressions are getting TV credits than this and that, then then it's really not going to happen, because it's like if Mariano Rivera, imagine if all I had was the Trump impression, but it was the best out there, and then it wasn't getting recognized, you'd go, oh, I guess it's not going to happen for me. You know, like his one pitch, the cut fastballs, he had one pitch, but he was so good at it that he became a fucking unanimous Hall of Famer. But I just see it, like one guy blocked me, and then another guy like kind of, and these are comedians I don't respect. Oh, fuck off, landline. For real, who the fuck calls at 8:30 in the morning? And you're probably saying, who has a landline? I do. Okay, I do. So, but these are like, that's what bothers me, is that like, I know I don't want to be grouped in with this group of mediocre comedians who only have this and aren't even that good at it. I just want, it's like, yeah, mine's the best, so do with it what you will, and then can I please get back to being a stand-up comic, hopefully with a larger audience, because it's so weird being in this like group, but like this one guy who does like a fucking cartoonish impression, and Mark Hamill this week, Luke Skywalker, retweeted like a tweet accusing me of stealing the lip syncing bit, and he gave me this humongous blast where he said, J.L. Kavan's brilliant impression is so good, people are accusing him of lip syncing and stealing it from someone else. Not only is the impression one of the best, which I took a little exception to, but he said, but the content, the writing is so like off the charts or whatever he said. And that was awesome, because he has a huge following. And then like one of these impersonators like had some of his fans like tagging like videos of him on the thread and being like, hey, JL's funny, have you seen this guy? And it's one of those things where I'm like, oh my God, come on. Like, and because it's so cheesy and not good. And it I don't know if anybody saw My Blue Heaven with Steve Martin and Rick Moranis, but when Rick Moranis says to Steve Martin, who's playing a gangster, Rick Moranis goes, capisce. He mispronounces capisce. And Steve Martin pauses and looks at him and goes, are you trying to say capisce? It's almost like they should redo My Blue Heaven with Sebastian Maniscalco as the gangster. I'm not even kidding. That would be fucking hilarious. But he goes, are you trying to say capisce? Well, don't do it, because it hurts my ears when you do it. And that's how I feel when I see some of these Trump impersonators. I'm like, oh God, I can't, like, and I don't want to take that much pride in it, because I want to be like, I have so much else to offer, but I'm also not stupid enough to know that this is my way in. Do you know what I mean? Like, this Trump impression is my way in, which is why it gets frustrating when I see it taking a back seat to far inferior content, or sharing the spotlight with like anybody with ears and eyes should know is inferior content. But it's such a push and pull because it's like, I want to defend it vigorously because it's my way in. It's the platform that's gotten me. It's the tool that has gotten me a platform 50 times as big as I had 3 months ago. But at the same time, I'm also like, I don't want to be one of these petty losers who's like, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this, as if I don't have 20 other comedy tools in my tool belt, so to speak. So it's weird because I don't, it's like I want to be I want to get eyeballs for the Trump, but I don't want it to be the end all definer of my career. Or if it is, I don't want it to be defining me so much that nothing else gets respect or views. I hope that makes sense. And I think that's all I'm going to talk about it because I've been very, you know, like I said, 3 months in, celebrities have contacted me, people from elementary school, an old podiatrist of mine, everybody, sports writers. It's like the whole gamut, New York Times reporters, everybody, except agents, managers, and bookers. So it's again, I mean, it just feels like this is headed towards just being, you know, the greatest of my career disappointments. But we'll see. I'll try to be optimistic, and I want to, and that'll be the last you hear of this from this, you know, unless I'm right in September about Saturday Night Live, and then we'll revisit this, but I'll leave it be from here on out. But this is my safe space, folks. So let's talk about, what's going on in the world. I think it's obviously friggin' tragic what's going on. It makes me sad. I have that luxury because watching the killing in Minnesota is like, I don't know. It actually made me sad. Like the Rodney King, I was a teenager. The Rodney King, or was I even a teenager? The riots were 92. I forget if it was 91 or 92 when he was beaten on tape. But I remember it was very scary, but I wasn't paying super attention. But I could see that tape and be like, my God, they're just beating that man on the ground like mercilessly. And I felt this, the Greg Floyd murder was more disturbing. Because as bad as the Rodney King beating was, and it was awful, it's one of those things where you're like, he didn't look, I hate to, like, trust me, this is going somewhere. In comparison, Rodney King was like still moving and still able to, like, in other words, yes, they could say, oh, he was getting up to hit us. Nobody who isn't an idiot or a bigot believes that. He was being beaten mercilessly and he was unarmed. But in the Greg Floyd case, he was incapacitated and begging for his, like you're watching it going, this man, there is no interpretation of this where you can be like, he's a threat. And then the New York Times put out this like 8.5 minute video through security footage and other cameras where you're like, this was no threat. And then of course I see that he was a big sort of muscular guy and the main cop, but they're all guilty, like flat out. Like the main cop is going to get most of the heat, understandably. Chauvin, which is another thing. It's like, I get famous during a virus that sounds like my name, and then months later, the biggest story in the country is a guy whose name looks like mine murdering somebody. That's the JL Jinx in full flex. But it reminds, like Spike Lee, Do the Right Thing. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It'll be rather triggering, though, right now. But it was like Radio Raheem, played by the late Bill Nunn. Big guy. Gets choked to death, which precipitates a riot at the end of the movie. Spoiler. But it's been 31 years. But you know, maybe you know. You should, I would think you might know what happens in the movie without having seen it. And even in that one, I remember one of the cops, I believe, if my memory serves me, was like tapping the officer who was choking the guy to death, like, you're going too far. this didn't even happen in this case. But the Radio Raheem death, it makes it all the more laughable that that year Do the Right Thing was not nominated for Best Picture. I would have said it should have been nominated and Glory. I forget what year now. I think it was 89. Yeah, 1989, another summer. Right. Driving Miss Daisy won because that was the sort of friendly race relations movie, the unrealistically friendly. It's a good movie, but it's, you know, it's the fantasy, the race relations fantasy. And I remember Glory wasn't even nominated that year also. That annoyed me. But hopefully, I think I have my years correct in the Oscars. But it reminded me of that end scene where it was just this, I'm going to take down this big black, to use Trump-like phrasing. And watching the guy, I mean, it is, of all of these videos and killings, it's the worst. I hope I'm not missing one, but this to me was like, and we've had kids get shot, but this was not a shooting. This was not a split second decision. This was a 9-minute, I'm going to impose my will on you, you big black. That's what it looked like. I mean, the guy had his hands in his pockets while he was doing it. It was like this, it was like almost like one of those Don Jr. hunting photos where he, you know what I mean? Like where that's what it looked like to me. And throughout the video that the New York Times said, he said he was claustrophobic and wouldn't get in the car, but he wasn't like fighting and flailing and all that. And then when the cop says, you got to get in the car, like the guy with some of his last breaths is saying, I'll get in the car, but I can't breathe. And the guy stayed on his neck for another minute after he lost consciousness, and not one of the cops stepped in and did anything. And it was, I got people in my family who you know, and I'm in partly in agreement, you know, with the looting and stuff, thinking that's on an individual basis, I think the looting is wrong. You know what I mean? I think I have no problem with looters being prosecuted if it comes to that. On an individual basis, I think it is wrong. As a collective action, though, and I know this may sound weird, but as a collective action, I think it's what needs to happen. And I am saying that as somebody who finds, I don't watch this shit and cheer and feel happy. And I'll get to my law enforcement career, I guess, soon. But I feel bad for all parties. Yes, there were cops still acting like animals and pieces of shit during all this. But I'm the type of person, and I think I've talked about this, I'm the type of person that when I hear about like a child molester, I don't have kids, but I'm not one of those guys who goes, I hope he goes to prison and gets fucking murdered. I don't have, like, I'm not that type of person, whether it's religion or just, you know, some other ethical principle in me. I'm not like, I see that and think that's sickness. And it requires punishment. Yeah, I'm not, that's once again, but I really don't have that. I hope, like when Gaddafi got fucking brutally murdered, I feel bad. I'm not saying that it doesn't make me think the people are good or deserve less than punishment, but suffering to me is suffering and I don't like it. And I'm not in a position, you know, it's that kind of thing where, hey, if somebody murders a member of my, fortunately, I've been lucky. I had my father for 38 years, roughly, 37, almost 38 years. I still have my mom, my uncle, my brother, his family, a girlfriend. Like I tragedy has not hit my life. All my relatives who passed away that were alive during my lifetime passed away at old ages, you know? So I've led a life where tragedy hasn't really hit yet, knock on wood. And I'm not saying like if something happened to somebody in my family that I wouldn't be, you've heard me be angry on this podcast. I can talk like fucking Maximus from Gladiator when a club booker doesn't return my email. So I am very capable of anger and animosity to high degrees. But when it comes to human life, I maybe have the privilege or the good fortune clearly to not have that fall upon my family yet or things I care about. But I'm not one of those people who's like, well, that child, I go, that guy's sick and he deserves to be punished. But I'm not about that, like dispensing God's justice and letting criminals rape and murder somebody as like retribution. I find that that's me. I don't like the death penalty. I don't like. So when I watch these riots and things, I get anxious for everybody involved because I look at the cops and I say, there's plenty of shitty cops, but they're not all shit. And clearly, like, and that's got to be scary for everybody in these things. And I'm not saying the sympathy should be with the cops that did the crime, but to me, if a cop is doing his job and he's getting a brick thrown at him, and you don't know if there's bombs or things in the crowd, and you don't know how bad things are going to get, there's got to be a lot of reasonable fear. And so I feel bad all around. And maybe that's not the tone people want to hear. I mean, you have signs saying fuck the cops, and you know, I've never been in a community that's been over policed. I've never been hurt, you know, because of how I look. Look at me, a guy with a face that looks like a natural scowl, 6'7", 300 pounds, walking around. If I looked black, I'd probably be treated differently. Probably. I'd be treated differently, but I don't. So I just get, you know what I mean? Like, it's even being half black, I'm not having as negative a life experience as I would if I looked more Obama-ish and less Italian Adam Sandler-ish. But I feel bad all around. I feel bad for store owners. I feel bad for protesters that are getting tear gassed. I feel bad, obviously, for people who endure police harassment. I feel terrible for Floyd's family and friends. But I also feel bad for the cops, some of them. And but who am I to pick out which ones I should feel bad about? Obviously, if I see you like punching a woman in the face, I'm not going to feel bad for you. I'm going to hope you get prosecuted. But to a lot of these guys, they're just doing their job to protect the community and property. And you know, and I think this weirdly doesn't come from my experience as a prosecutor. Because I made a joke about this on Twitter, but I meant it. I was always amazed at how, and I did a track on Keep My Enemies Closer about this, about like the arrogance you see with police officers. It's like that uniform and that gun make them arrogant. It's a mentality. It's like a power mentality. But I always joked about how it extended to cops and like infidelity. Because when I was at the DA's office, I mean, I saw so much fucking sleazy detective and cop behavior, just guy married talking to a female ADA trying to get her number and describing all the women they slept with and the fact that the wife was mad because the guy banged some chick he used to bang. And I'm saying that and the women weren't exempt, by the way. It's obviously it's a much more heavily male profession, but there were women who weren't, you know, acting right either, if I can be a little judgmental. But that was my joke, where I was like, oh, these cops, they don't, they act like they're NBA players. You know, they make 25 grand out of the academy, and you'd think they were, a member of the 96 Chicago Bulls with the chicks they're pulling and the attitude they have. But what I learned as a prosecutor, I never got to the level where I never had like police abuse. I did have some police, you know, when you'd get complaints about police behavior, I did work in that. We handled that in my bureau. That was among the many things we handled. But I never stayed long enough to be involved in like super high profile or super life and death sort of cases. I mean, I second sat a murder trial once, but that wasn't my case. But what I learned being at the DA's office, and maybe this is a little bit of where my, I want to say empathy for cops comes from, but I saw my own attitudes changing. And I've said this before on the episode, so if you're new to this show, you don't know this story. But while I was at the Bronx DA's office, and you know, the Bronx is a vastly majority county in New York. And so when you're seeing cases come in, whether there be small cases, big cases, domestic, you're always seeing a level of homogeneity in terms of the ethnicity of crime of alleged criminals, and you're always seeing the worst because your entire job is to deal with people accused of crimes, not with the broader community. So all you're getting is negative input. And you are largely seeing Latinos and black people as well. But from where I was, 85% of everything I saw in my 3.5 years there was Latinos. And I remember at the time I was dating a Puerto Rican woman, and I started to feel real anger and disappointment in the Latino community. And who the fuck am I? I'm saying this. This is the experience of doing this job day after day. And I started to be like, I didn't ever say anything like any slurs or anything, but in my head, you start going, and it's, you know, like you're hearing about, you know, my ex, my girlfriend at the time, she was a single mom, and I'm hearing stories about her, and she's from the Bronx, and about her ex-husband, who was like, you know, your sort of stereotypical philandering macho Latino guy, and then stuff with her family, which was also just like the kind of stuff that reinforces stereotypes. She was great. She was a great person, and sort of, I was always impressed with her background and the people she'd been associated with, and the fact that she was, it felt like she was swimming upstream to just be the person that she was. And so that internalized a sort of personal anger in me on her behalf. And then you go to work each day and everything is Sanchez, Vasquez, Gutierrez, and you start to get this irrational sort of anger. We were like, I'm connecting all of these things, both personally and professionally, and going, what the fuck is wrong with these people? Like, you start to have that thought. And fortunately for me, I think I'm a smart person. I'm a thoughtful person. I went to schools where I was exposed to a lot of things. And I obviously came from a biracial household. And I think that combination of things made me check myself repeatedly. And I was sort of, one of the things I was very relieved with leaving the office when I left, even though I didn't really, I left for other reasons, which we don't have to get into. Nothing professionally. It was a personal decision. I was engaged at the time and went to a law firm and tripled my salary. So that felt like a smart decision, even though it wasn't really the decision I wanted to do if I was single and living my own life. I kind of liked the day-to-day lifestyle out, you know, most days at 5. It didn't interfere with comedy at all. But I found myself thinking more often than not those kind of thoughts that are like, you know, bigotry adjacent. And I saw it with a member of my family who's a longtime public school teacher, worked with special ed in the Bronx, and, you know, I think wanted to do well, but year after year, he was losing his sympathy and, you know, would say things that would put me off, even though I, at the same time, had to do this balancing act that I've had to do basically my whole life, which is interpreting people's words versus their heart. And, you know, when you're showing up to parent-teacher conferences year after year, and your whole student, your entire student base is pretty much people of color, and two parents are showing up out of, like, you know, a possible 60 to two parent-teacher conference, and kids are misbehaving. But I could also see that my uncle always, well, there it is, was my uncle, but like, you'd see the frustration build. And it's understandable, but you have to be like, you have to check that. And not everybody can, not everybody does. Because he took great pride in, like, the student. You know, it was one of those things where he took real enjoyment and pride when students overachieved or when they were just good kids. So he never lost sight of that. He never lost sight of individuals' capacity for goodness and growth. But at the same time, in the aggregate, I think he also developed sort of hostility because it was frustrating. And then, unless you're vigilant, you can start to blame things that are broader than the people. You start to breach out from blaming an individual or having concerns about an individual and just assuming the whole system's broken and everybody who's involved in it is the same or has the same problems. And that's how I felt I was getting after only 3 years at the DA's office. But I'm the type of person who, you know, I didn't need bias training or sensitivity training because I could do that on my own. But I do, this would be my thing when people mock bias training or things like that. This is why I think it actually still has some value, because if you don't think of these things on your own, you have to, somebody has to make you think of them. And I'm sure some people don't want to think about them. But if the whole point is, if you have 100 cops who have to go to some sort of training and only 3 of them change their ways or have their, well, that's still 3 that have changed their ways. Isn't that better? It's the old why you should vote for Joe Biden. Isn't, even if you don't like the person, isn't better the option you should want? You know, just like I think if Mike Pence were president, I think we'd be in a better place than Trump. I didn't say we'd be in a good place, but I think we'd be in a better place. So I think always trying to do a little bit of good is better than doing nothing. But I just can't, like, this isn't to the cops that killed George. Did I say Greg? Fucking A. I think I said Greg. Greg Lloyd was a linebacker for the Steelers. Christ. George Floyd. I guess I'm not as awake as I thought. I think I said, did I say Greg Floyd? Because I had Greg Lloyd of the Steelers in my mind, I guess. George Floyd. I'm not excusing them. I think what they did goes beyond anything that's reasonable. But it makes me feel like law enforcement is almost an unhealthy profession. And I'm not trying to excuse. I'm not excusing the bad actors, but there's such an area to become a bad actor in a job like that, because it's, if you're not vigilant, if police departments are not vigilant, which I'm guessing they are not, I'd love it if everybody was like me, that as soon as they start to hear their own voice or their own thoughts, like I said, I never even expressed this stuff verbally. This was all internal dilemmas I was having. But when you start to feel that, if you can't self-police yourself and go, hey man, check yourself. I know it's frustrating. I know this is a natural inclination, but you gotta check this before it gets out of control. Then you need serious programs in place to stop people from basically starting to think of groups as, and the other problem is, I think when you have cops, you probably have a lot of people getting into the business with the preconceived notions. What I'm describing to you is somebody who had no no thoughts, biases at all. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, yeah, I'm happy to, I'm excited to start this job as a prosecutor. And these things developed. So when you have cops who go in with already preconceived notions and ideas and prejudices, like they're already entering the job with that, those are going to be even tougher cases, I think. But it can happen to people who go in with the best of intentions. Like I said, it can happen with schooling. It can happen with being a lawyer. It can happen on anything. And I think you are in a position where there needs to be, you know, I think we've turned sensitivity training into a joke, but I think it has a real place. And I think maybe it's not being used as much. It's not being employed as well as it could be. But I think that stuff is important, because a guy like Chauvin, the cop in Minnesota, maybe he's irredeemable. Maybe he came in. I mean, he's had like multiple police shootings. He killed a guy, and maybe the guy was a stone cold killer and deserved it. Deserve is a strong word, but maybe it was a justifiable shooting. But I'm saying, when you see somebody doing what he did, either you came into the job thinking of black people as less, or the job has made you think of black people as less than human. Because that was, like I said, that was a hunting photo, is what that fucking looked like. Not a cop doing police work, not a cop in danger. That looked like a hunting photo where a guy had killed big game. And these jobs do that. I think these jobs can do that to people. That's my, I'm using my own experience, and projecting it, but I think my experience is a somewhat instructive one, because, not to make myself sound like better than anybody else, but if that can happen to me, just those thoughts and that anger, and to say, if I was still a prosecutor there, I'd be there 16 years now instead of 3.5. Good God, time has flown. Time has flown by. Flied. Maybe I'd still be fighting the good fight and not thinking poorly of people, of certain groups. But maybe 16 years on the job would have turned me into a real fucking asshole. And that's a scary thought. But I don't think it would have, because like I said, I think I was self-policing my thoughts and checking myself and reevaluating and having to like affirmatively avoid the job from making me think things that aren't true and that are prejudiced. And I don't know, I'm just saying, like, I think that's maybe where some of my sympathy comes from, not for the cops that killed George Floyd, but for the general police force is, I think, why I think there is something flawed. There are flawed people who become cops, that is for sure. There are bad people who become cops, that is for sure. But I think also the complex of law enforcement, I think, can make decent people into not decent people, and that's the bigger challenge, I think. I hope it's sort of weird admitting this, just these kind of thoughts, but that's the truth, and I think our law enforcement system, whether it's cops not living in their own, in the communities they police, or cops being disproportionately not the same race as their own, although plenty of black, Latin, and Asian cops turn into real pieces of shit as well. That's more evidence that it's the way we do the job, that's the way it's structured, that I think is so damaging, because most people who become cops, I would like to think, are not bad people. They're people who take pride in it and believe that, it's a good job. You get good benefits. So don't get me wrong. It's not like they're fucking volunteers. But, it's an important job. And it's a job that I think when done right, you can take great pride in. But I don't know. There's something flawed with the way we do criminal justice as a whole. And I don't know how to fix that. I just figured my own experience was pretty instructive for me in terms of making me maybe not as angry and condemning all law enforcement the way some people are. But I think maybe the truth is most cops are all right, but the way we do law enforcement in this country is very wrong. Maybe that's, I don't know. Whew. So that's... but the George Floyd killing, and my apologies if I don't even remember if I said Greg Floyd before, but like I said, made me think of Greg Lloyd, who was a Pittsburgh Steeler linebacker. This one was really terrible. And I, like I said, I don't, individual looters, and this may sound, seem counterintuitive, but like I said, individual looters, I have no problem with them being prosecuted. But at the same time, in the aggregate, I look at looting and burning, and I really don't like the violence, and it makes me scared for all parties involved. But on a historical, if you from a view 10 miles up and 50 years out, I think there's an argument to be made that without this chaos, change hasn't come. Like everybody's been bringing up, we need peaceful protest, and yet the president called Colin Kaepernick a son of a bitch for protesting this by taking a respectful knee. People called him a son of a bitch, and he was banned from his sport, basically. And everybody can flip over and do gymnastics, and I genuinely don't have any respect anymore for the, hey, well, he's not that good. Why is he? I don't even respect that argument. And I'm suspicious of people who still make it. You can, of course, argue now, well, he's been out of the game for 5 years or whatever. Yeah, yes, of course. Now you can make that. But to make that argument and then retroactively apply it to like the year he was at first out of the league. No, you can't do that. He clearly was good enough to be in the league. And yes, this argument will cease to be valid when he's 50, but you can't then retroactively go, well, no team should hire him because he's terrible now. Yes, but no team hired him when he was still good. And it sort of shows you that the violence, as bad as it is and as scary as it is, has made the powers that be wake up and go, oh, we should have talked and sat down and thought about this when we had peaceful protest, instead of demonizing peaceful protest and turning it into a political football. And now that's what they want to do. They want to talk, they want to listen, they want to have, and it's because of the violence. And it's a catch 20. It's like, I don't like the violence. I wish the violence wasn't happening. And yet the violence in the aggregate and the mayhem is having, it's scaring people into more serious thought and action, I think. And that's the catch 22. I don't want the violence, but the violence is the only thing making more, you know, is having more impact than peaceful protest. And we don't even have to get, I mean, Donald Trump, like I wrote on Twitter last night, if you still need Joe Biden to earn your vote, like, fuck off. If you didn't vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016, I don't want to hear from you. Like, whenever somebody says I didn't vote for Trump, but I go, fuck, like, I'm tuning out of this conversation, because that's like some escape hatch. Like, hey, I didn't vote for him. You had two choices. Your choices were Trump or not Trump. I liked Hillary Clinton. I think Hillary Clinton would have been an excellent president. And for anybody who tells me she was a flawed candidate, I go, no, this is a flawed country. She was a fine candidate. It's the country that's fucked up. Since when does super brains and experience not count for something? In this country, we like to pretend as a meritocracy. Well, meritocracy lost on the biggest vote ever in 2016. And now, so I don't want to, I genuinely don't, when I hear people say I didn't vote for Trump, but I'm just like, I'm, you can keep talking, but I'm not listening anymore, because somehow, I don't know what you thought could happen or what battle you thought you were winning by not voting for Hillary Clinton, but I don't give a fuck if I don't. Hillary Clinton could be doing daily Benghazis. let me rephrase that. Daily what people think she did in Benghazi, and it would be less loss of life and less terrible than the Trump presidency. It's a joke. The Trump presidency is an evil, cruel, sick joke. And you had two choices. You know, I voted for Hillary Clinton, but to those people who didn't like Hillary Clinton, you had two choices, Trump or not Trump. And you chose Trump. And for the people who are sitting around, and I love seeing certain type of progressive on Twitter, like now in the middle of COVID and riots, who are like, Joe Biden's going to have to earn my vote, or like, this is why Bernie would have been the best. I'm like, you need to fuck off. Like, if you can still look at this and be like, the priority, and I get trying to get concessions, but Biden did put together this like big kind of panel with like AOC and like kind of putting together like a coalition of the John Kerry's of the world and the AOC's of the world to try and build a coalition between the progressive and centrist wings of the party. But to me, as I've said, I'd vote for Hunter Biden's butt plug over Trump. Like, nobody in the Oval Office is an improvement, let alone a decent guy with experience who's clearly only going to run for one term. And that, to me, speaks even more of his nobility of purpose, that he's doing this to set the country. And for people who go, normal isn't good enough, I'm like, normal is better than Trump. And if Biden's saying, I'm going to run, and he doesn't run for a second term, how can you hate on that? He's giving you that avenue to that change, but you have to turn off the Trump faucet first. And for people who look at this and go, I'm not voting for Biden. I'm you can miss me with that shit. He's not, but it's incredibly selfish and so disgusting to me. that you can watch this presidency and think, yeah, you want to have a perfect thing, but the thing is, Trump is the worst. He's the absolute worst. And to not vote him out is like disgraceful. And to come up with whatever like intellectual or bullshit argument you want to come up with that you think sounds good to either your super, super progressive Brooklynite friends or your white suburban, I didn't vote for Trump, but we need somebody more like Marco Rubio, and that's who I'd support. Fuck off, all of you. Biden. Biden 2020 to fucking save this country. I don't mean he's going to save the country like he's fucking Leonidas in 300. I mean save the country by not being Trump. That's it. This is Trump in his first term seeking re-election. What will he be like when he's trying to set it up for Don Jr. to run in 2024? What kind of, when he doesn't have to run again, what kind of bullshit do you expect to happen? And you can still sit there. I personally think people should fucking, I hear almost nobody ever apologize for not voting for Hillary Clinton. Like, how in God's fucking name could you believe that Hillary Clinton could be not just like, she would be even to somebody who hates Hillary Clinton, how can you not see that she would be a vast improvement in terms of tone, efficiency, policy than this dude? And this of course is not talking to people who like Trump. If you like Trump, fuck all the way off. Fuck off. I'm not trying to convert you. I'm talking to the people who are too woke to vote for Hillary, or too woke to vote for Biden, or too fiscally conservative, or just don't like Hillary Clinton. I'm talking to you people. Like, what in the fuck is wrong with you? That you can't see the error of your ways? And that you still might double down on not voting for the candidate with the best chance to beat Trump? God damn. So anyway, yeah, that's my rant. That's this week's episode. So we hit on some good things. I talked comedy. I talked about, I almost talk about the DA's office. Like I was like one of those like supremacist gang members who like got out and then appeared on Maury. It wasn't that bad, but it was like, I could feel things building up that I did not want to feel in terms of how I thought of, and some of that was personal. Some of that was me projecting also my personal life at the time, dating somebody who, you know, had stories that were reinforcing negative things in my mind. And then the work was reinforced. It was doubling down on that shit. And it was a good thing, I think, to get out. But I think getting out, the system still persists. And that's where the big, big, big changes, I think, need to occur. And that requires federal action. That requires federal sensitivity. And I hope, as Kamala Harris, I think, was saying on the news last night, getting a real law. But I'm not just talking, unfortunately, about, you know, penalties. That's an important phase. But I'm talking about culture change that needs to happen. And that's, you know, other than climate change, I think changing the very culture of law enforcement in this country is a daunting responsibility that will require buy-in from people of both parties and require a generation or two of change. That's the scary thing. And we don't seem to want to do long-term change anymore in this country, whether it's climate change or law enforcement. But we need, we need real change. And I don't know. It'd be nice if it happens. But I don't know. But that's my story about my experience in law enforcement and the negativity of it. So I hope this was somewhat, I don't know, interesting to listen to. But it's, we are in tough times right now. And once again, like I said, meant no disrespect, obviously, George Floyd, not Greg Floyd. I'm pretty sure I said Greg Floyd. And now I'm like nervous that I said it, because you're going to hear me say it like 20 minutes into the episode and be like, did he just say Greg? Yes, I think I did. Maybe I didn't, but I think I did. So I feel very bad for him. Obviously, he's passed away, but and for his family and his friends. This was... this isn't just a cumulative effect. This is the worst of them all, I think. You know, there have been children shot. There have been people beaten. There have been men shot in their back. But this, there's not only a cumulative rage about this. This also was the most outrageous of all these tragic deaths. He was like a hunter treating the man like an animal that he had put down in the wild. And that, you know, that will require justice. You know, but I don't know. It's all very sad. And this week's episode of Making Podcasts Great Again, my podcast is Donald Trump, which you should listen to if you're not. But that was a tough episode to do because we started talking about real stories and I almost abandoned the episode. I almost said to my co-host Jay, I was like, can we not do this week? Cause a lot of this stuff just doesn't feel, I can always make jokes as Trump in character, but I was like, in my head, I was like, this doesn't feel right at all. But then, so we the show sort of organically steered to much more absurd and, to be honest, sexual things, but it actually felt good to, even though it was a little more vulgar, it felt good to just not try to lampoon or parody this current news cycle because there's nothing funny about this. And this is what I've said about portraying Trump, why I can't do it after 2020. Because I'm barely able to do it now, to be honest. And I know I'm getting a lot of views and stuff for it. And I'm trying to be humorous, but also make a point with it. But if he gets reelected, it's just not fun. It's barely funny now. And this week was very tough. But, you know, I don't know. If he loses, I'll feel much better about continuing the impression than if he wins. Because if he wins, it's just what a disgusting fundamental statement about this country and the way we elect leaders and the way we look to leaders and the way we think of ourselves. He's not going to win the popular vote, but that's like small comfort because the system we still abide by, there's enough people to reinforce the Electoral College to give Trump a much better chance. He'd have no chance. He'd have no chance if we had a popular vote. We'd be counting the days till he was out of office. In fact, if we had a popular vote, obviously he wouldn't even be in office. But, just a rough week, but I thought, I don't know, I thought my experience as a prosecutor, limited though it was, has some value in terms of how we should maybe rethink approaching law enforcement. Because if it can, not to say I'm a better person, but I am a very educated person who is exposed to, you know, multiple races in my own home. And in my schools and in my life experiences. And I was susceptible to creeping prejudices that can really, you know, turn frustration into something more insidious. And I sort of was conscious of that, and that was a good thing. But not everybody is conscious of that, or not everybody does that kind of reflection. And I think we need to do something different with law enforcement. If it's, I don't know how, because it's, you're talking about a cultural and structural change that will require at least a generation. And do we have that anymore? Do we have that capacity to do it? We can't do it with climate change. We can barely do it with fucking masks and hand sanitizer. So that's why this week was very tough to be funny, I guess. So I hope you found this episode somewhat interesting. I think it had some value. Who knows? But thank you for listening. If you need a real laugh, go check out my stand-up albums. Just go to jlcomedy.com. Go click, go stream or buy some of that. Not much political material on those albums, just laughs if you need it. I guess that's it. So thank you for listening. Thanks for subscribing if you do. Feel free to share this episode if you think it has some value. Even though the Trump pod is the one that's paying the bills, this show has been going almost uninterrupted for, 8 years. So, obviously it means something to me as well. And I get to speak in my own voice, sometimes funny, sometimes not funny. So thank you for listening, everybody. And I will see you next Tuesday.